Happy holidays from Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Before we get started, I just want to say how much I appreciated this year everyone who's been listening to all the episodes, and for you making Word Balloon part of your day. I really appreciate it, and this is a great opportunity for me to say thank you. Today we'll be talking to artist Mike Hawthorne, who discusses the tone of the newest and strangest series from Vertigo, The Unmen. Written by John Whalen, The Unmen were a group of monsters introduced in the original Swamp Thing series, but the group has evolved far beyond the original concepts of Len Wein and Bernie Wrightson. We'll discuss the book with Mike and touch on some of his other past projects, like Rule with Ivan Brandon and Jeff Amano, and Queen and Country with Greg Rucka. Word Balloon is brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics are yesterday's prices. In December, you can pre-order The Unmen number 7 for just $1.85 at MailOrderComics.com. Make the switch to MailOrder Comics, where you'll save up to 75% off of all your pre-ordered comics every day. You'll also find incredible savings on figures, statues, posters, magazines, and more. They match their amazing discounts with unprecedented customer service. You won't find a better service anywhere, and all your purchases are backed by their 100% satisfaction guarantee. So order in confidence today. For more details on great deals, head over to mailordercomics.com. Word Balloon is also brought to you by The Overman from Image Comics, a 5-issue sci-fi noir that follows hired killer Nathan Fisher as he fails to stop an apocalyptic union of mankind and machine. His discovery of a cryptic plot to change the face of evolution sends Nathan spiraling down a roller coaster of imminent destruction. Read what Broken Frontier calls a story that promises to be grand in scope. Mark Waid says, riveting. I couldn't put it down. And Ain't It Cool News states this is a truly memorable and impressive debut series worth checking out. For more information, go to their website, theovermancomic.com. I appreciated the you tapping me on the shoulder and saying, hey, you got to check out The Unmen. Because I remember them being a Swamp Thing group of characters. Right. And for people who don't know and don't know the backstory, and you don't need it because it is explained in that first issue, but it is kind of cool that they have been around the DC universe before and now part of the Vertigo universe.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And for me, I'm sort of going to be counted as one of those people that wasn't real familiar with them. They were slightly ahead of my time, which John Whalen hates, you know, did I say that? Because he's a tiny bit older than me. But yeah, I mean, they came around, I guess, in 73. I wasn't even born until 75. So I never really got into them until I signed on to the series. And DC sent me a ton of these trades to sort of get up to date on the history. And, you know, here I was just kind of falling for these characters. They're so creepy and crazy. And John has just done fantastic things with these characters. And he also incorporates one of the characters from a Unmen sequel of sorts, which was called American Freak.
Yes.
Which I haven't read, unfortunately. DC doesn't seem to have anything in print. And all I've flipped through are some, you know, just some computer files of it. But again, John is just, he's been real smart about it. He's tied all this stuff together, but still stayed very true to the roots, so to speak, of these characters.
Absolutely. And it's been fun to read. And that's the thing, because it sounds like it could have been an Alan Moore creation, but it really wasn't. It was a Len Wein, it was during the Len Wein era that these characters came out, and Bernie Wrightson doing the book.
Yeah, I mean, our main guy, Cranius, he's right there, and he was one of the first guys you ever saw from the Unmen, and he was just this little, you know, one of Arcane's little underlings that sort of yelled at the other bigger kind of hulking Unmen to, you know, get to work kind of thing.
Yeah.
And now he's it's just brilliant the way John's brought him back and made him, you know, kind of a star in his own. I mean, I don't see how you can have a brain on a hand and not have the guy steal the stage. So for me, it just makes perfect sense. Like, yeah, he should be the star of the show.
Well, and that's a great design for a face and for that kind of freakish look. So
yeah,
that's got to be a blast.
I made him a little uglier than I think Mr. Wrightson did. I think, and part of it is just because I think his work has a charm to it, even though he's drawing these kind of grotesque figures. They're charming.
And, no question.
Where I think mine is probably, I shot for that charm, but I think he's a little too, I don't know, like he might hurt you kind of guy. So, I don't want to just say this and sound like I'm trying to just pump the series because I'm working on it, but there really is nothing like this on the stands right now. And I think part of that is because John is keeping, you know, one foot in the history of the Unmen and the Swamp Thing. But you know, doing more modern stories with it. But right now I'm working on issue 7, and he just has these fantastic moments that have kind of a, there's sort of a nod to the old EC horror books where, you know, some kind of just fantastic thing happens and you turn a page and you go, my God, what the hell, you know?
Well, and did you ever see Todd Browning's great film from the early 30s, Freaks?
I have not.
Oh, it's amazing. And, you know, Todd Browning's the guy who directed the original Bela Lugosi Dracula.
Oh, wow.
And it's great because it's only an hour long, and it really is this amazing film where there really are circus freaks in the movie and stuff. And it's this great little murder mystery that happens in a circus.
All right, I'm going to have to dig it up.
Oh, totally worth seeing. Yeah, no, you absolutely have to. And that's
Well, it's funny because a friend of mine, when I signed on to the series, this friend of mine sends me this VHS tape of the old Swamp Thing cartoon, which I wasn't aware of either.
Oh, I didn't know. I remember the live action one. I didn't remember the cartoon either.
This was great. It had this great theme song. I can't sing, so I'm going to embarrass myself. But it was to the tune of Wild Thing. It was like Swamp Thing, don, 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 and it's so comical. But he sent me this episode that just happened to have the Unmin in it.
No kidding!
And,
wow.
Well, and it was so goofy because they took it. They made it really this kind of Ninja Turtles freak mutant kind of thing. So there were these Bayou thugs that were freaks and then get even more freaked out because of Arcane's experiments. But Arcane is like this, you know, kind of muscular, dark-haired, young, kind of vibrant, you know, tough guy character in the cartoon. He's not the old, you know, the old man from the original.
Yeah, the creepy rich old guy from
yeah,
the original.
Yeah, it's great. It's cheesy as hell, but it's great.
Oh, that's really funny. No, you know, and the live-action Swamp Thing show, I think, was a little bit better than I gave it credit because, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it just looked like crap. I know it was filmed like at Disney and everything.
Yeah.
It did. I mean, you know, it wasn't Alan Moore Swamp Thing. So I think
we all got kind
of jaded and were like, well, then I don't want to bother with it. But but there were some great ideas from that original run, and certainly the Young Men are one of them. And also the pacing of your guys' series so far reminds me of that X-Files episode where Mulder and Scully go and visit all the freaks.
Right. Okay.
You know, and I think there's it opens the door for a lot of interesting designs for characters.
Oh, for sure. And you know, I keep getting comments. People will see the book and they'll say, man, who came up with, I can't believe you came up with this crazy thing, whatever it may be. But John does a great job of throwing in these little notes that work to the visual side of you know, making comics, which a lot of times writers will sort of leave it up to you. They'll say,
okay,
you know, I'll throw a crowd of freaky people here, where John will say, he'll add these little details that are great. Like the one thing that a bunch of people had asked me about was Janice and Janice Jr.'s chair and desk. Janice is the one whose son is on his back.
Yeah, for people who don't know, one of the power brokers of the town.
Right,
and
right.
And it's like if Ted Turner had his own son growing out of his back.
Basically, yeah. So, and he's this crotchety, just mean little bastard on his back, and he's always... You know, he's that nasty voice in your head, only he's outside. And but John came up with this great idea for, like, Janice's chair where it has a hole cut out and a desk on the back so little Janice can have, like, his own power desk. You
this
know?
Is
and
a little work area.
He comes up with this crazy stuff. You know, people assume it's me because it's in the artwork. But he's really thought all this stuff out. And you mentioned Alan Moore. I think what he has in common with Alan is that sort of kind of an overall vision for what's going to happen there. He's not like a domineering kind of a writer, but he has a very clear idea of how this could all work out. And if I change something, and as long as it works, that's obviously okay. But I mean, even down to like the desk, you know, he has all this stuff thought out. And I can't say enough about that. I think he just makes the series that much more rich because I have so much to play with. And you know, if I add a little bit to what he has there, it just makes it that much more well-rounded, you know?
Well, now, and I had heard of your, and I had enjoyed your artwork before The Unmen, but I hadn't heard of John before this project. So where did Karen Berger find John? Do you know his backstory?
He was drafted directly out of high school. He skipped college.
No
No, I'm just kidding. John did a couple of little things, I think, here and there. I think he worked on some of the big book stuff that DC puts out.
I love that stuff. That's great stuff.
Right, right.
But, from Paradox Press, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, but this, the one thing I've noticed is I think I see one of two things happening whenever people are mentioning John. Not that you're doing this, but I've noticed even some of the press stuff that comes out of DC is, you know, I've done enough books now that I expect people to say, you know, Mike Hawthorne, and then you have the parentheses with whatever book you worked on recently.
Sure.
Or people will say, you know, tack on Eisner Award nominee Mike Hawthorne or whatever, which I love. I should probably put on a T-shirt or something. But
absolutely.
But with John, you know, there's sort of a, I think there's a fear like, oh, man, nobody's going to know this guy because he hasn't worked on any comics. But honestly, for me, I think it's sort of a testament to how good he is that I think the strength of his pitch was such that they decided, hey, we need to give this guy a monthly series, you know? So he has done a couple of things here and there, but nothing huge that, you know, you can tack on to the end of his name, but I think that's going to change big time after, you know, we complete this first arc. You know, he ends it in such a, like, big way. I think people are going to get blown away by it, so...
Well, I've read the first three issues, and I think he has a level of professionalism that if there are any fears by readers who haven't tried this out, don't worry. I think every issue is very – it gives you enough in each individual issue. The story itself is moving along, but it's not in any slow, decompressed pace that anyone would be disappointed. And a lot is going on immediately, and you're introduced to a lot of very interesting characters, but again, all very tied to the story. So,
yeah,
and it's a good mystery. You've got a great lead in Agent Kilcrop from the Department of Energy, who is an albino that's been called in to investigate this murder. And, of course, you've got the overall concern of what has happened to Damian Kane and what the secret is behind his death. Everyone knows, and there's a cave, and that's part of the whole big mystery of where he is as far as the Unmen go, because at some points he was thrown away in the past by the Unmen, and now he's kind of revered, and that's kind of part of the mystery of the town.
He's done this really great thing, because he didn't just... John has set up this... wow, I sound like John's PR guy or something. I don't mean to.
Well, you're half the book, man. Yeah.
No, but I mean, I think what he's done is really smart, is he set up a class order in this town.
Yes.
And there are the run-of-the-mill freaks, the bearded ladies, you know, dwarves, that kind of thing. And they're the ones that revere Kane because he made this place for them. You know, this is the one place that they were supposed to be able to go to that was going to, didn't matter what their issue was, they were going to be accepted, and this was their home. And then Cranius comes along with some of the original Unmen, and quickly turns this thing into a theme park, you know?
Yes.
And so you have the locals that are almost in a religious way waiting for Kane to come back, and then you have the Cranius and his original gang, and then the Unmen that he's created, who are sort of, you know, they're the higher class, and they're running things, and they, you know, they get all the good jobs, and, and like the good apartments, and he's even set up where they're referred to as gas, which is, I guess, an old carny term for freaks. They work all the kind of menial jobs, and they live in trailer parks and all that stuff, because this is sort of where they're kind of pushed off to. So they've had this place, which was for them, and they've slowly seen it not only kind of get bastardized by what Cranius is doing, but also seen themselves get pushed off of the home that Kane has set up for them.
Yeah, it has its own community soap opera beyond the individual story, too. And there are beautiful people in this land as well.
Yeah.
Talk about Nico, the one-armed angel.
Right. Well, what she's supposed to be going for is the winged victory of Samothrace.
Yes.
Obviously, we can't chop her other arm and her head off, or else it'd be kind of hard to get the dialogue to come out of her, but that's what she was going for. That's what John was going for. You know, one of the things that was tough to really make clear in the series is that those wings are not wings. They're supposed to look like they're sculpted, as if they were stone or something, which is why they kind of colored a gray color most of the time. So, I mean, she's completely flightless. She's got these huge wings, but she can't do anything with them. This is just for show. And so, like, you know, when you say there's beautiful people, I mean, this is really she's a complicated character, but on the surface, it's really just about how she's supposed to look. She's sort of the symbol of this new town, you know.
Did Cranius purposely, is he the one that kind of made her the way she is? Or?
Well, we don't know. That's the thing. I mean, okay. I'm 7 issues into the thing, and I don't know. And John won't tell me. Son of a gun. He's like, I mean, he's got a plan, and he's been hinting at things about her. But honest to God, anybody that's read the series up to this point probably knows as much as I do. And it's sort of hinted that she chose to have her arm removed and the wings attached, but I, you know, I don't know why. I mean, oftentimes in the series, there's different characters that are getting changed because they maybe already had something wrong with them. Like, there's a character with a lobster claw. And I think, I could be wrong, I think in the series it's referred to the fact that he, I think, got into an accident of some sort and lost an arm, so why not replace it with a lobster claw instead? And, but I don't know if that's the case with Nico or if she just came out right and said, hey, I want some wings and why don't you get rid of this arm for me? I guess we'll all find out together.
But there's different levels of horror going on. I mean, Cranius himself, he's a Joseph Mengele kind of, sick kind of scientist that's doing these perverted, operations. And as, I don't know if we alluded to it or not, but this town is not only an amusement park, but kind of has a reality TV component to it
right,
as well.
Right, right. And that's sort of where they're trying to expand. I mean, they have the city all, as big as it's going to get, basically. And so now they're trying to branch out.
Sure.
And this is going to be the big thing for them. And so you have the tension of some of the things that are happening in the series that could compromise that.
Well,
and you mentioned Cranius is you want to relate to him because he's one of the main characters, but he'll do these terrible things. Like you mentioned the operation scene the operation scene, it serves a purpose. He's trying to find something out, but he's so heavy-handed, no pun intended,
yes,
about how he does his stuff that it's just cruel, you know?
Yeah, and it's what I like is, because I'm not a huge gore guy, but there's a horror factor in this book, but there isn't really a heavy gore factor, despite the content and despite the subject matter. It's really... it's okay. So, I mean, I think both sides will be satisfied. I think the horror fans who are looking for something really scary and the Saw fans of that area of horror will be satisfied with a lot of the things that are going on. But it isn't to the point where you can't look. I mean, it's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's a testament to your art because...
I don't know about you, John.
Well, no, I think why... Well, either that or I've become incredibly... Maybe I'm desensitized. Exactly. Maybe, sadly. But, I mean, yeah, I didn't have that kind of Eli Roth hostile and Saw kind of...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It's palatable.
Thank you. I really think it's because... I think you're seeing a lot of horror movies where I really can't get into them because it's really just... torture for the sake of torture, like just let's see how shocking we can make an image and story be damned. And I think with this, what we're trying to do, it's very clearly a horror mystery, and horrible things happen. But you couldn't take that scene out and still tell the story.
Certainly,
you really, really need these things to it really just it serves the story. These things are important to what's going on. And they're also, developing the character. So, later things, it's tricky because John has this thing all written in a way that if I say the wrong thing, I could ruin the ending. But
I understand.
You'll see that, like the end of issue 2 leads directly into what happens into issue 3. And it's kind of a gory moment and it's kind of a shocking thing, but it's important to the story when you read issue 3. And then it really becomes even more important at the end of issue 5.
Okay.
So all these things tie in, and although they're shocking and crazy, they really are all in service to the story.
Well, how long is this first arc?
5 issues. I'm actually a little more than halfway penciled issue 7.
Okay.
Issue 6 is a one-part thing, which is actually particularly strong, I think, because of... you talk about not doing a decompressed story. John does so much with just that one issue. We get to see Killcrop's history, where his family's from, what his connections are to just carnival life, and why he is going to end up in Aberrant.
Okay.
So it's just really damn strong, and you get and it has kind of a heartbreaking moment at the end, which is just great. It was nice to. I liked all the issues. I love these big shocking endings, but it was nice to end a story on kind of a touching and sad moment, you know.
Okay.
So, but yeah, it's good stuff, man. So I believe the second arc now is going to be another 5 issues, which is what we're starting now.
Okay.
So you should see the cover to number 6 is out, I believe, where it actually shows Killcrop and his brother fighting, and it's just beautifully done. But the issue to number 7 is just gonna knock your socks off. I don't think they're gonna leave it as is because it's so insane. But it's fantastic. He's doing a great job.
What background is Tomer Hanuka?
Actually, you know, Tomer and his brother. I was already fans of theirs. They used to do a book called Bipolar,
okay.
A comic book. It was kind of a Love and Rockets thing in that not the content, but. In that it was he and his brother who are both insanely talented.
That's cool.
Splitting a comic down the middle and you know, you do your story, I'll do mine. And it was great. And but Tomer's also a really, really established illustrator. You know, he does tons of stuff for, like big-name magazines. And if you check out his blog, you'll see he and his brother going back and forth between showing, you know, both their different projects that they're working on, and these guys are just insanely talented. I feel really lucky that he signed on for the covers, because like I said, I was already a fan of his. So
that's really
he
cool.
Also did the covers. I'm sorry to interrupt you. He did the covers a couple years back on the Focus line of books that DC did.
Oh yes, oh yeah,
yeah, that was him.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay, that's cool.
Well, and here's a funny bit of fate. I was actually asked to do one of those Focus line books years ago.
Which one?
I couldn't do it because I was already booked up. I was doing, I think it was Queen and Country and maybe Rule.
Okay.
And just couldn't do it as much as I wanted to. It was a story that took place in Philly. And I had lived in Philly. I think I had just moved back around the time that I got asked to do this. And Tomer was doing these covers. And I just thought, man, those covers are so awesome. So to me, it's so funny that, you know, it just came back around. Like, Faye really wanted him to be dressing up my comics and make them look good.
That's really cool. It's interesting with him is him and his brother. They're Israeli, and you got the Luna brothers, and you got the Hernandez. We
right,
got a nice
right.
little UN of brothers that do comics together and stuff. I think that's pretty
I know,
cool.
man. I need a brother or something so I can do a comic with. All I got is a sister, and all she can do is beat people up, so...
Now you mentioned Queen and Country,
yeah.
One of my favorite series, and I think one of the first things that I noticed of yours.
Cool.
And was now refresh my memory. Which story was yours specifically?
I did. Ours had a great, super tough title. It was Operation Dandelion. And but it's actually a high point in my career. It was just a fantastic script. You know, Greg would send me these 45-page scripts for each issue, you know, and you look at, like, you read this thing, and it reads like prose, you know, and it almost doesn't need pictures. And, you know, but if you add up all those pages and you realize how dense it is, and then, you know, look at the fact that I think mine was 5 issues or 4 issues, I forget. You know, he's writing a novel every arc just about.
Absolutely.
But I was working on that and another book at the same time, and it was just insanity. I was drawing and penciling Queen of Country every month, and then drawing, penciling a book called Rule, Ganglords of Chinatown, and that was 45 pages. So I was doing just about 100 pages a month in addition to covers and other stuff. So, but it was Operation Dandelion.
Okay.
Which we actually, that year, we were up for an Eisner. Along with, I think Jason, what's the guy's name? Oh, is he
Jason Alexander?
Fantastic. I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. But
Jason Alexander?
Jason Alexander. I think it was and Carla, I believe.
Carla Speed McNeil, sure.
Yeah. So Yeah, it was a good year for Queen and Country.
There you
apparently.
Go. Yeah, that was, no, those, the, you know, a wonderful series, and it was always fun to see the different artists that Greg would get either
yeah.
partnered up with, or I don't know how much, if he chose you guys, or if Oni was the guy, the people.
You know, I don't know. When I started working with those guys, I just sort of said, look, I really want to draw this book, so whatever, you know, whatever it takes, just please keep me in mind. And there was a waiting list at the time. I think it was something like a year. They had the thing, you know, scheduled out.
So. Wow.
But it worked out perfectly because I was wrapping up. I had just done 3 days in Europe with them, which was a romantic comedy.
I remember that as well. Another great
right.
Oni book. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and that was also a favorite of mine, actually. Anthony Johnston, the writer of that, is a good friend, and I think he's brilliant, and I can't believe they haven't, like, tapped him to write something really big.
No.
At least Constantine. I just assumed, you know.
Sure. No, I agree. I think he is the next. He is one of those next great British writers that, if you know your independent comics, you're aware of
right.
his work, and he's excellent. And I know Greg
yeah.
loves him too because he's given him a couple Queen of Country or that
that's
one Queen
right.
of Country
yeah,
arc
that's right.
to,
which I couldn't believe. I thought, Jesus, you know, this is a high compliment. I think because it's one thing to work with different artists, but I just couldn't believe he had tapped Anthony. But then it made perfect sense because. Really, Anthony is smart enough to pull that off and willing to do the research it would take to really make it work. And
no, he stepped right in and he kept the flavor of Queen and Country, and it was great
yeah,
to
sure.
see. It was wonderful.
He works with Alan Moore, for God's sakes. I mean,
there you go.
It's, you know, what can you say?
Well, and I remember Rule, actually. I'm glad you mentioned that because
yeah.
I know that David Mack did those
David
wonderful
Mack did the covers.
Did those
yes,
wonderful covers.
Yes. And Rick Remender inked me on it.
Oh, that's great. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. We actually worked together for a while. We did the Terminator 3 movie adaptation together.
Very cool.
And then went into 5 issues of Rule, which was, you know, 45 pages per issue. So I tortured the poor guy. I had never worked with an inker before or since. And I really didn't know what the hell I was doing. I would send this guy pages and get them back and think, my God, this guy must think I'm insane with this stuff. That I was penciling because I was so used to making corrections in the inking stage, and so I would make little mistakes that I would have normally fixed, but he would get this page and I'm sure he just looked at the thing and thought, you know, I can't believe they're paying this guy. But he swears he never thought that. So
that's cool.
And Rick and I are good friends, and so yeah, I'm proud as hell that he's, you know, as successful as he is right now, and. You know, we've been hearing about those stories that you guys are finally getting to see.
Like Fear Agent and Strange Girl and all this?
Yeah, I mean, I remember him just first showing us, you know, the first piece of art that Tony did for Fear Agent and the logo, you know, trying to get different logo designs done, you know, and it's just so cool to see that it's doing as well as it is. You know?
That's great.
Yeah.
No, that's really cool. Yeah, I'd like to see your take on Heath, the Fear Agent.
We were talking about doing a short. But, you know, in a way, I actually pitched in and did some layouts for Tony for an issue.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so I don't know that you'll see. I mean, Tony's doing an amazing job on this. I cannot believe. Tony was always good, but I think he's just pouring so much into this book. I guess I shouldn't be talking about other books during my interview, but I'm going to do it anyway. He's pouring so much into this book. It's just insane. It's mind-boggling. He showed me some of these pencils. I thought, my God, Tony, how the hell are you drawing all this stuff and still keeping this thing monthly? But he's really just banging it out, and I was really honored that they asked me to help out at all. You know,
that's very cool. Now, and yeah. Rule was Jeff Amano writing Rule?
No, actually, friend of mine, Ivan Brandon, wrote it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
of
Ivan
course.
is known for, you know, NYC Mac and 24/7.
Yes.
And he was writing it based on some. Jeff Amano wrote the sort of story outline.
Okay.
And then Ivan scripted it. So,
I see. Oh,
yeah,
okay, that's cool. Yeah, those Beckett comics were very interesting. And
yeah, I mean, it was cool to see. Well, it was cool to really get in there when they first started out, and Jeff really had very unique ideas for what he was going to do with comics and. You know, some of the stuff I don't think people necessarily got. I know some people felt that Rule was a little slow in the beginning. I mean, the first, I don't know, 8-10 pages of the first issue, there weren't even any words. It was just building up this, showing what the world was like now.
Uh-huh.
But with a 45-page comic, it made sense. And then, you know, you just jumped. Once you set up the world, you just jumped headfirst into this whole story, which is, loosely based on the story of Gideon from the Bible.
Yes. Well, that was the interesting thing, yeah, that he would,
yeah.
They would have based a lot of these stories on biblical stories and a lot of legends.
Right.
As well.
I think all the rule, well, the both rule stories are based, because I think the next one is Samson and Delilah.
That's right. Yes, indeed.
So, yeah, I mean, but, you know, we were really going to try to do our Akira in some ways.
Oh, that's cool.
And I don't know that we succeeded or anything, but we tried. And we also, you know, we kept a 45, excuse me, we kept this 45-page, book coming out every month, which was an undertaking in of itself, you know.
I bet.
And I'm proud of that. And then I jumped straight from that to Ballad of Sleeping Beauty, which was probably even more unique than Rule in that, it was the story of Briar Rose told as a Western.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was the great thing, mixing these genres, because, yeah, I mean, like you said, the two Rule books definitely were biblical stories, but
right.
told in this kind of noir style, and
right,
not
right.
preachy at all, but just really taking the essence of just legend. I mean, it's legend that happened to be in
exactly.
the Bible. So, yeah, I mean, but I think I can see where some people might be turned off. I'm not the most religious guy in the world. I saw a cool crime book in both cases and said, oh, I got to check this stuff out. And then
right.
realized, more so with the second story, I'm like, wait, this is Samson and Delilah. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and the same thing, he twisted Robin Hood as well. I know he
made
that into kind of a samurai story.
Exactly.
So,
you know, and in a way, it was, I remember being at a convention and a lady coming up to us at the booth, and she's asked what Rule was about, and I gave her the whole spiel and told her how it was based on Gideon. And not knowing this person was like a devout born-again Christian.
Okay.
And she just went, like, her eyes just bugged out, and she goes, you know, oh, I love Jesus, and this will be perfect for me. And she went on and on. I thought, my God, you're going to read this book and come back and want to kick me in the head. It's not anti-religion in any kind of way, but if you bought the thing thinking, you know, this is a Bible story, you were going to be disappointed.
Absolutely. No, I hear you.
But if you bought it and you understood where the source material was, where it was coming from, but saw that Jeff was trying to, you know, do something unique with it, and you got it, then people, you know, then you loved it. So.
Oh, absolutely. No, I highly recommend people check out some of those Beckett comics in the trades, and they were all reasonably priced. And if you can find them at shows or at stores...
Well, I think all that stuff is now through Image. So,
oh, there you go.
Yeah, I think it's pretty readily available.
Oh, wonderful.
And Ivan was doing some Ivan took a hammering sometimes with the critics, I think, with that book because of the slower pace. But they were missing the point that it was 45 pages and it was, I think, $1.99.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to mention that too. They were very reasonably priced books.
Right. So and Ivan was really taking the opportunity to just tell a story in not rushing it. I mean, he used to say, "I don't want to hold anybody's hand and walk them through the plot." And so, you know, again, if you could get into that, then people really seem to love it. You know,
that's cool. I noticed that Whiskey Dickel is among your comments.
Yeah,
very cool. Our pal Mark Ricketts.
Yeah, I did this. It was one of my, actually it was pretty early on. I think I was doing that around the time I was doing 3 days in Europe, and Whiskey was I can't remember how long ago it was, but it was, I have sort of a soft spot for it because it was one of these books that we had intended to do more with, and it just never worked out. We were going to do a bigger 5-issue series out of it, but from the very beginning, actually, I just decided that my heroes, you know, guys like Alex Toth and Williamson and any number of other guys, always did work in a number of genres. And I just decided early on that I was going to be that guy, too. I was going to try to do as many different kinds of books as I could. So, you know, I did Whiskey, which was this straight comedy, and it revolved around a traveling all-girl rodeo review.
Yes.
And, yeah, it just sounds crazy already. and then, you know, jumped around between romantic comedies and spy comics and a Western and, action stuff. So at this point, yeah, it's kind of crazy. I've actually looked back on it recently, and I realized I had, you know, about nine actual books to my name, and then like maybe another three or four that I've contributed to, and realized none of them are superhero comics. I don't know how I've managed to do comics for, it's going on 10 years, and not have done a superhero comic yet.
Well, that's cool. Now, is there, before you get into any thoughts of superhero stuff, is there a non-superhero genre you haven't done yet that you'd like to do?
I haven't done a war comic.
Okay.
Which I think I would like to do, although the Fear Agent thing that I did layouts for is essentially a war comic in space.
The Last Goodbye.
Yeah. So, I get these beautiful boxes full of DC books. Now I'm doing a book for them, and I'm flipping through them one month, and there was a trade for The War That Time Forgot.
I've got that sitting on my
bookcase. Yeah, and I thought, that's for me, man. If somebody ever brings this back, I want to draw that. Just dinosaurs fighting old soldiers.
Exactly.
Actually, I would have loved to draw on The Unknown Soldier.
Oh, that's really cool. I love The Unknown Soldier. Those war showcase books.
Oh, they're awesome.
I've picked up every one from The Haunted Tank to, you know, The Unknown Soldier and War That Time Forgot. Absolutely.
And
that's such a cool character. Do you ever try and look for any of those old issues? Because Joe Kubert, man, that guy was amazing on The Unknown Soldier. It really was.
You know, that stuff is out. It's just amazing. And it's funny because I was talking to an artist friend of mine, and we're looking at some pages that I had done for this short horror story called Salem. And he's looking at this stuff, and he's like, man, there's a lot of Joe Kubert in these. And I thought, my God, I didn't even... Joe was one of those characters, my God, sorry. Sorry, Mr. Kubert, I didn't mean that. I mean, Joe was one of those artists that I think I was always aware of but didn't really follow his work the way I probably should have. And just slowly started to sort of grow an appreciation for his work. Until I think he just started to sneak into my work without me really realizing it. And so, I see a lot of him in my work now, and Jordy Bernay.
That's cool.
Alex Toth, and now sort of I've been getting more and more into Al Williamson.
Excellent.
Yeah, so, if I can steal just enough from them to look good, then I'll be happy.
What is your art background before you were doing comics? How did you...
I my background is in painting. I have a degree in painting from Temple University's Tyler School of Art.
Wow.
Which is, yeah, it's apparently supposed to be a big deal. I don't know. I just found out recently from somebody who was listed in that U.S. News and World Reports thing. I think it's like number 3 or 4 for painting for their master's program.
Wow.
And, yeah, so I actually know how to paint, although you wouldn't know it from looking at the comics, but... I studied painting there, and I also went to the Pennsylvania Governor's School for the Arts. And it's funny, as I was ready to graduate from Temple, I got approached by a couple of the teachers there about going to the Academy in Philadelphia and getting my master's program. Or, I'm sorry, getting into their fledgling master's program, forgive me. Basically they were saying that the dean was an alum of Tyler, and that I could probably go for free if I taught a drawing class. And I thought, you know, to hell with that, I'm going to do comics. so now, I mean, I can't complain because I got a beautiful career, but I do kind of sometimes wonder if I probably should have gotten it, you know.
Wow. Well, I was going to ask, do you have time to paint in between comics?
Now, or? I don't, unfortunately. I haven't painted for a couple of years. I studied painting because I really had intended to paint comics.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, if you ever would, you know, put the two together, but go ahead.
Yeah, that was my goal. And then, you know, some guy, what's his name?
Alex Ross
or something.
Sure, I've heard of him.
Yeah, he came along and beat me to it. No, but I mean, that was my goal. I was going to be Alex Ross before there was Alex Ross, really. or at least when I was a kid, there was nobody like that doing stuff here
sure.
in the United States. And it's just one of those things that, for some reason, as I got more and more into comics, I painted less and really started to fall back on the fact that I could draw quickly.
Okay.
And so, you know, really never, my schedule's never allowed for me to be able to sit and paint a comic. And then it's right around the time I started to get work regularly, my wife and I started a family. So, you know, I've sort of gotten to the routine of trying to get a paycheck every week. But one of these days, I think I will probably sit down and just maybe start with covers or something and just start slowly, you know, painting again.
Wow.
Yeah, it would be nice. I don't know if it'll happen exactly soon, but I'd love to.
Now, it sounded like you alluded to that when you said there aren't many that do it here in America, painted comics and stuff. Are
right.
there European artists? You mentioned Jordi Brunet. Other international artists that you enjoy?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there were always, especially as a kid, I flipped through the heavy metal and you'd see guys doing this fantastic stuff that didn't look anything like what we had here.
Yep.
I think probably my two favorites in terms of artists from overseas would be Jordi, obviously, who's just probably my top five in terms of favorites. And there's a guy, and I'll probably say his name wrong, but Dennis Bodart or Bodar.
Okay.
Who's a favorite of mine. This guy does, it's a more cartoony style, but it's beautiful stuff. So I think and it's great now because we have the internet and I can kind of, troll around looking for whatever obscure artist I might be coming across, whether it's, some old comics or whatever.
Sure.
And but it's great. I think you're seeing less of an over here, over there kind of mentality. And there's a lot of guys there's a ton of Argentinian guys that are doing beautiful work here.
Oh, absolutely.
And then where you're seeing more American comics come out there. My book Umbra just came out in France in March and it's coming out in Brazil
Oh, that's great. That answers my next question. I was going to ask if you've had anything play overseas yet. That's
yeah,
excellent.
Actually, almost like immediately. I think 3 days in Europe came out in Spain and France and maybe one more place. I'm not real sure. And it was a kick for me to see these books because you get comps from the foreign publishers and it was just a special thing for me to pick up a book and realize like my God there's somebody in France somewhere reading a comic I drew but the most recent one has been Umbra which was a 3-issue series I did with Steve Murphy at Image. Steve Murphy is He's the Mirage's main guy. He was writing just about all those Turtles comics that were coming down the line.
Oh, okay.
And also works on the TV show, but his primary job now is handling the licensing deals for the Turtles. And he has started doing books on the side. He was planning on starting an imprint, and has a bunch of books that he has that are really either done or just about ready to be done, and Umbra was sort of the first one, and we decided to put it out through Image, and I think each issue was 40 pages.
Okay.
And it's you'd like it, I think. It was a whole murder mystery that takes place in Iceland.
Oh, cool.
The main character is this forensic expert that discovers the remains of a body in a frozen kind of a glacier cave, and they find out that it's only about 5 years old, but it's the bones of a Neanderthal. And I don't want to say any more because really it just ruins the whole mystery of it. But it's this great kind of X-Files, whiteout kind of feel to it. And we were actually up for a Harvey this past year.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, we lost to some. What's it called? Daredevil or something?
Those hacks, Brubaker and Lark. What do they know? They suck. They suck.
Yeah. No, but I mean it's cool because each time I've been up for one of these big awards, we always lose to a good book. I mean, we lost with Queen and Country, we lost 100 Bullets, which is a favorite of mine.
It's a great book, absolutely.
Eduardo Risso is oh, again, probably my top five in terms of my favorite artists. So, but yeah, it was cool just to be nominated. They treated us real nice. I couldn't believe how, I mean, God, they fed me. I was so stuffed. I didn't even care if we won at the end of this thing. They fed us, you know, like filet and crab cakes, and I just...
Well, that's really cool.
Yeah, I could have just fell asleep and died, and I would have been happy.
Is Umbra out in a trade yet?
No, actually. Image decided not to put out a trade. But what we're hoping to do is either do it ourselves or maybe work out a deal with somebody. But for now... The issues are still floating around out there, and it's also available on. You can, I don't know how exactly it works, but Steve worked out a deal with these people at UClick where you can read it on your phone if you feel like reading a comic on your cell phone.
Oh, that's cool. Okay,
yeah, it's pretty cool.
Well, I just happened to look online and got the old Newsarama story that Chris Arant did on you guys.
Chris is a great guy, yeah.
And I see some of your art in here, so that looks really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And, no, I'd be very curious to check that out. That's interesting.
It's funny. That book spans just about my entire career. I started that thing before 3 days in Europe.
Wow.
And it took me up until, you know, maybe a year or two ago, I forget when we first started putting it out, to finish it. Because we just, you know, Steve hired me on, and he said, excuse me, he said, don't turn down other work to do this thing, because he wasn't in a huge hurry.
Okay.
And that was a huge mistake. He shouldn't have said that, because, you know, things just took off after that, and I've been busy, so I would just squeeze in pages whenever I could on the weekends or whatever.
I got you.
It took me a long time to finish, but it's kind of a bright moment for me. I think this book is especially strong.
Well, people are going to have to check the bargain boxes to look
for
the three issues until you guys maybe get the rights back and are able to release a trade.
Yeah, that'd be well. We have the rights now, which is the beauty of the
Image
deal.
That's good.
It's just a matter of, you know, Steve is. We're just not in a huge hurry to just put out a trade just for the sake of having a trade, and he wants to sort of sew up all the other books that he's doing and maybe put the whole thing out either himself or, like I said, through somebody else if we can work out a deal of some sort. Because he's got, you know, we actually have another book called Sturgeon River, which is, actually, I'm almost done. And that's going to be a graphic novel. It's 118 pages. So, you know, and then he's got a book with an Argentinian artist named Dario Brizuela. I'm probably saying his name wrong. I'm sorry, Dario. I still love you. But it's called God's Dog, and it's I won't say too much about it, but the point is he's got several books on the back burner that are ready just to get going, and I think he wants to put together a plan before he just jumps into a trade deal with Umbra.
Okay.
So,
right.
But I actually have them on my site if anybody wants to pick them up at thinktankcomics.com.
Okay, very cool. And is your blog there as well, or do you have a
different... I actually have... a ton of stuff there. There's a daily web comic. I started my career with a book called Hysteria. I self-published.
I wanted to ask about that, yes.
Yeah, starting in 98. And that thing bounced around with just about every indie publisher there is, with short stories being published by, you know, Slave Labor and Radio Comics. And it's funny because... On you've seen the Heidi McDonald's blog.
Yes.
And she mentioned when I launched the series, and Dan Vado from Slave Labor makes a comment like, I don't even remember even publishing this thing, which I thought was funny as hell. But they had a book years ago called Love and Tights, and they put out a Hysteria short. And then it bounced around to Oni, where I put out a graphic novel for them, a collection of shorts. And then to Image, where I did One Man Gang, which just hit a brick wall. Which I'm wrapping up now, but now I'm starting over, basically, and putting it online as a webcomic, starting with the original series I self-published in 98.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so 98, people, 99, sorry.
People can rediscover the work online now.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So
well, what's
it started, I guess, about a month ago or so. And I also have a feature called Monster a Day. It's just literally a monster a day. So and it's black and white every day, color on Sundays.
That's very fun. And you just draw a single monster every day?
Yeah, it's just a goofy monster of some sort. It's sort of a play. They'll have goofy names, which my wife has been helping me out with. She actually reads a dictionary and finds words that sound like a name.
Nice.
And it's a ton of fun. I just sort of do it to warm up and have fun with. And we put that on there. And so there's, you know, there's also my work in progress blog, which has just a ton of stuff pertaining to whatever books I'm working on now or side projects, you know, doing some art prints and such. But it's all there at Think Tank, thinktankcomics.com.
Excellent, man. Well, dude, thank you very much.
Don, thank you for having me, man. I appreciate it.
That's artist Mike Hawthorne, and make sure you check out The Unmen from Vertigo Comics, written by John Whalen. It's a very interesting series, and I encourage you to check it out. Word Balloon is brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. Don't forget, this month, December, you can pre-order The Unmen Issue 7 for just $1.85 instead of that $2.99 cover price, only at MailOrderComics.com. Make the switch to Mail Order Comics, where you'll save up to 75% off of all your pre-ordered comics every day. You'll also find incredible savings on figures, statues, posters, magazines, and more. They match their amazing discounts with unprecedented customer service. You won't find a better service anywhere, and all your purchases are backed by their 100% satisfaction guarantee. So order in confidence today. For more details on great deals, head over to MailOrderComics.com. Word Balloon is also brought to you by The Overman from Image Comics, a 5-issue sci-fi noir that follows hired killer Nathan Fisher as he fails to stop an apocalyptic union of mankind and machine. His discovery of a cryptic plot to change the face of evolution sends Nathan spiraling down a roller coaster of imminent destruction. Read what Broken Frontier calls a story that promises to be grand in scope. Mark Waid says, "Riveting. I couldn't put it down." And Ain't It Cool News states, "This is a truly memorable and impressive debut series worth checking out." For more information, go to their website, theovermancomic.com. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, you can find Word Balloon all over the internet. Of course, we're here at newsarama.com, but we're also at iTunes, at myspace.com/wordballoon, comicspace.com/wordballoon, various podcasting and podcatcher sites. And, of course, if you ever have any questions or comments about the show, feel free to email me, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, happy holidays. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2007.